As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm delighted to be joined today by Jonathan McKenzie. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. We are going to focus today's episode on Spurs. Why wouldn't we do that? A very normal thing to do. Why are you asking? It's normal. We are going to do that. And to do that, we're joined by none other than Nathan Clark of the Extra Inch podcast, which
hello.
Is a Tottenham... Well, you said hello very early there. Too early. Wait. Hold on. Of the Extra Inch Tottenham podcast...
Hello.
Oh, look, second time round, that was perfect, wasn't it? Yeah. Anyway, listen, we're going to dedicate a lot of today's episode to Spurs. We haven't spoken about them much so far this season, but later on, we've got a bit of Brighton. Roberto De Zerbi has been anointed as the new chief of Brighton. And of course, there could be more potential manager upheaval. So we'll discuss some of that later, as well as a bit of Erling Haaland. Yes, very exciting. And if you like to be excited on a regular basis, you should visit theathletic.com/TIFO, theathletic.com/TIFO, where I expect there will probably be, between now and 8 years' time, about 1,000 articles about Haaland released, all of the good ones. John, what have you read on The Athletic recently that you've enjoyed?
I enjoy our new tactics guides, so I enjoy Liam Tharm and I enjoy Ahmed Walid.
Ahmed Walid, yeah, they're both very good, aren't they?
They are.
We should get them on the podcast soon. And are you a subscriber of The Athletic, Nathan?
I believe I am.
Oh, really?
I think so. That's I have been in the past. Yeah. Is that close enough?
I suppose so. What have you read in the last couple of days?
Also tactics pieces, yeah. Almost exclusively.
From Liam Tharman.
Quite likely.
Ahmed Walid, right. Sure. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? Anyway, that's theathletic.com/TIFO. Theathletic.com/TIFO. Please do that. But for now, I will leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of Nathan Clark. Tottenham Hotspur. Nathan, 17 points from 7 games. That's just 1 point behind Arsenal so far this season. And Arsenal, of course, are, you know, this season's darlings of a team. Whereas Spurs, I think, whilst people expected them to do very well before the season began, the sort of general feeling from some Spurs fans and from neutrals is that they haven't really been playing that well. But they really are only 1 point behind. I mean, presumably that's quite a good thing, isn't it?
I prefer to be in front, but I think... last season, we were excellent under Conte, genuinely, like not too far behind City and Liverpool. And so the expectation coming into this season, like we invested pretty well over the summer. So the expectation coming into the season is that we would like really tear it up. And again, points wise, we've been fine. You're right to say that the performances haven't been the most encouraging, but sort of been fine. I'm optimistic that the performances will improve. I think that a fair bit of it has come down to personnel so far this season.
Mm. Well, I mean, don't they say, though, that like if your team's not playing that well but they're still winning points, that's like the sign of a championship team or whatever, you know?
Championship team?
Well, you know.
They don't want to be a championship team.
It's an Americanism, but you understand. Okay. You take my point.
Yeah, in I think that is true to the extent where if you can ride out the periods of time where you're not performing brilliantly due to personnel reasons or tactical reasons or whatever, and still come away with 17 points from 7 games and then later play well, then that's true in that sense. But just getting results for a while isn't on its own isn't
so what is it about the performances at the moment that make you think that there will be an improvement later in the season? Because I think it's fair to say if there is an improvement from this stage, that's a very, very good thing indeed.
Yeah, so I think we've seen a lot of Davinson Sanchez and we've seen a lot of Emerson Royale. And we've seen a lot of teams coming out to press Tottenham, and I think that those in combination have really undermined our ability to have our share of possession. Obviously, there's always an extent, a considerable extent with Conte, as to how much he wants to concede possession, how much he wants to let the opposition onto him to counter him behind, especially when ahead by a goal or two, of course. But I think that we barely pressed at all last season. And then we spent pre-season practicing pressing the opposition high. Mm. We came into this season intending to do that a bit more, and we haven't really put that into practice. We haven't controlled games, which I think was the idea coming into this one. And again, I think a lot of it is personnel. We've missed the players that we want in order to do that in games.
Who's supposed to be playing instead of Davinson Sanchez?
Christian Romero.
And Christian Romero is just injuries, is it?
Just had a couple of injuries.
Is he back fit now?
I think he was only rested for the Leicester game, right, perhaps, because we've obviously got a lot of games. But Davinson Sanchez is a perfectly fine defender, but very weak on the ball. He is the natural backup to Romero, and Romero is not going to play, you know, 60 games this season. So,
okay. Yeah. And with Emerson Royale, it's a Jed Spence issue, isn't it? Which we'll come to discuss a bit more later, is it not?
Yeah, it's a general right wing back situation. So we spent a lot of last season playing Emerson Royale, and then Doherty came into form, developed his game, was able to play to his strengths, which is sort of being a striker in the box kind of thing. And then he's been injured and unfit entirely this season. We assumed that Emerson Royale would be leaving over the summer, but he's played almost every minute of right wing back so far this season.
So when Doherty regains fitness, is the expectation that he would play?
Yeah, I think we were just sort of expecting that to happen soon. I think Conte said that he's regaining fitness over the international break and should be back after that. Okay. And then obviously Jed Spence was the big shiny new right back that we brought in that has seen the pitch for a few minutes playing as a winger. So, yeah.
Okay, well, let's do a whole thing on transfers later. But John, having watched Spurs some of this season so far, what are your overall feelings?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this comes down to aesthetics, right? Like, a lot of people will watch. You open by saying Arsenal. Everyone loves talking about Arsenal, and Spurs are sort of like winning but not playing particularly great football. Mm. But and I agree, obviously, with that assessment. But the big question is, to what extent are we influenced by the aesthetics of what's going on? Are Spurs playing in a way that is aesthetically unattractive but functional and able to be repeated for the rest of the season? That's the big questions for me about Spurs. Whereas with Arsenal, we spent a lot of time on this channel being like, they're playing a really sexy style of football. Mm-hmm. It just makes me sound really old, doesn't it? Like,
yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. You are quite old.
I am quite old, but yeah. I like to think that I'm less old than someone who uses sexy as an adjective to describe like football teams. But
sure,
they're playing like the form of football that...
The sexy form.
Yeah, yeah, that Pep Guardiola has brought in and and everyone sort of accepts as being good football.
Sure.
They also have introduced like a lot more structural flexibility and stuff. So the sense that I get from Arsenal is that they are playing at a level which is sustainable and should get results. But we could be over egging the pudding and how good they are, because it's the sort of football that people say that's good football.
Too many eggs.
So yeah, but my big question with Spurs is like, how sustainable is the way that they're playing football? And yeah, as Nathan's saying, he's suggesting that like things will need to improve if they are to carry on at that and that sort of level. But and that's the question, like, where did those improvements come?
Well, in order to ascertain that, I think it's probably best for us to talk about what Antonio Conte actually does as a coach. I mean, we saw him a lot last season. He's not completely fresh, and obviously we've seen him in the Premier League before. We'll come on to talk about him in the Champions League as well, because that's slightly less exciting maybe than he would be throughout a league campaign. But Nathan, Antonio Conte, what is it that he's doing?
Okay, so the principles of Conte's play are not like we have the ball, we don't have the ball. They are when we have the ball, everything we do with it is prescribed and rehearsed by me in training. So it's entirely pattern-based. That is the fundamental element of Conte's football. And that
automatisms, I've heard so much about from John.
That's it. That's right. It. That's exactly it. It's strange, right? Because for Spurs fans especially, it's like we've come from this era of Pochettino. Mm. And Pochettino, like, was brilliant and transformative to the team and brought Spurs back to the Champions League, all of that, and also was dad, right?
Yeah.
Whereas Conte is a colder figure.
Mm.
And I think more so when he first came in, I think we sort of softened a little bit. I am wearing a t-shirt with his face on it.
Right, oh, yeah, so you are.
Yeah.
Look at that.
But yeah, when he first came in, it was very much this sensation of like two parties sort of coming together for mutual benefit without any kind of affection.
Sure.
You know,
yes.
I guess that's all of football in a way.
But my like, wife and I.
Yeah, for example. Especially as a former Chelsea manager. We've had too many former Chelsea managers, right? Things definitely softened a little bit, but there is a coldness. There is a realization that he will, in the space of a year, 18 months, decide that he's had enough and wants to leave, as there is with every club, for the most part, I think.
I mean, it all sounded at times over the summer like he might leave, and that was odd because they did so well.
This is kind of the Conte thing, right? He's always going to badmouth the board to the press. He's always going to have that threat, and he sort of earns the right to do that, you know? I think... maybe I'm just like falling for the same traps as every club before, but there is a sensation that this is a little more long-term minded, that he's speaking about we need to have two or three summer windows. This is a long-term project. He's not just going to, like with Inter, come in, transform the team in one summer with an enormous amount of spending and win the league and then run away again.
I don't think that's unreasonable, because if you consider the number of teams he's managed before, he doesn't have that many places left to go that he hasn't already been.
Yeah.
And I wonder, when you get managers a bit like that who kind of reach the end of the merry-go-round, whether they just, as a result of not really having anywhere that they haven't trodden to tread again, they just sort of stay where they are, or they change their, you know, stripes slightly.
Yeah, so there's a range, right? Because the four or five best teams in the world, except for maybe Real Madrid, they don't really want what Conte has to offer. Come in, win the league guaranteed, spend all your money and leave.
Yeah.
Because they're looking for more long term. They're looking for more of an effect on football overall. And then every team outside the world's top 15, top 20 are kind of irrelevant for what we want as well. So yeah.
It's Champions League as well, isn't it? Like, a lot of big clubs are just like, we need a manager who's going to win a Champions League. And
that's why he's not the PSG manager, right?
Which he was strongly linked with, which is very strange.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Well, when you watch him, John, say what you were going to say before I started to ask a question.
I was just going to ask Nathan what he feels about having a manager who is heavily automated. Like, has watching a manager who is that prescriptive changed your ideas about football, or changed your enjoyment of football?
Well, I think it relates to the previous point of, in terms of like Conte only spending a maximum of two and a half years at a club. How much of that is him, his personality, his demand of the board, and how much of is the players getting bored of running the same rehearsals and having everything they do micromanaged over that period of time? And kind of also, again, relates to like talking about our form. It's like when Conte came in, I was sort of preparing myself emotionally. The second things start to go sour with Conte, don't hold on to that. Don't be like, oh, he'll turn it around, he's really smart, cut it. And where I'm here going, no, it'll be fine, we'll turn it around. It's very different from all other football, right? Because still to an extent, I'm like, hey, we need like an elite ball-playing midfielder. We need a playmaker. No other coach, I think, in world football could have, could run the midfields we've been running and play as aesthetically in parts football like he has.
Do you find when you watch games, though, that you've just seen it before in the last game?
You know where it's going. But
is that not really predictable for the opposition? I don't understand how it works if you are an automatisms coach. Like, presumably, opposition coaches just need to look at your automatisms and then go, well, here's how we counter that.
Yeah, I think so. I think there should have been more of that in football. I think that Tuchel had that nailed down. And I think where other teams try... it has to start with like the first phase of possession. You can't be like, oh, well, Kane's going to pass it to Son, so we'll just try to follow Son because he's left you in the dust, right?
Mm.
Oh, we'll just tackle Kane as he's turning. Oh, I've got a red card.
Yeah.
So it has to start with closing down the front three, and teams have had some success doing that here and there. Tuchel really was on that, and so other coaches should be studying what he was doing and copying him and using those ideas, because any system can have counteractions, right?
Mm.
But by and large, teams struggle to implement those ideas. When they press really high, they exhaust themselves.
Well, it's quite interesting what you were saying before about, you know, that of the top five, six teams in the world, apart from Real Madrid, they're not looking for a Conte type. And I think it's also fair to argue, based on what Real Madrid are at the moment, that they're also probably not looking for a Conte type. Like, Ancelotti has quite literally said, put Real Madrid's success down to the fact that opposition teams have no idea what they're going to do because the players are trusted to find solutions on the pitch.
Yeah.
And I couldn't think of something more anti-Conte than that, John.
Yeah, no, not at all. And I suppose that's just one of the weirdnesses of the way that football has gone, that the biggest prize now has become a knockout tournament.
So why can't he do it in the Champions League?
Well, I suspect Nathan will say that a big part of it comes down to his inability, Conte's inability to rotate squads very well.
Mm.
And that's what we've seen happening this season as well so far. So I suppose when you're so into micromanaging everything, you will look at your squad and say, they're my best 11. So if they're fit, then I want them on the pitch because they're going to be the ones who are going to be enacting the ideas that I want on the pitch. So yeah, I think it comes down to the fact, which seems weird, right? Because if you're able to plan in the abstract in the way that he is, you would think that that would allow him to be able to
automatically.
Yeah.
Yes. So what's the issue with rotation?
I think he prefers a smaller squad for the reasons that John has said, and about trusting certain players. Maybe
a bit like Mourinho.
Yeah, I guess a little bit like Mourinho. But yeah, I think it's just general squad management has undermined him. I think also the point about why don't coaches just learn the patterns in advance, maybe that applies a little bit to Champions League. If you're like, oh, here's the big game we've got coming up in 4 weeks, let's dedicate loads of time preparing for that. Whereas a league game coming around every week is harder to give that level of dedication to. So maybe to an extent his football is more domestic league friendly than it is knockout competition friendly, but not to the extent. I think he has the capacity as a coach to win the Champions League. I think he's of that level, of course.
It's just quite shocking, I suppose, given the calibre of teams that he's managed, that he hasn't done better in that tournament. It's not just about not winning, right? I mean, plenty of coaches haven't won. It's about not going very deep into the knockout stages.
Yes.
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 I was going to say something that's now entirely escaped my mind because...
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I'll come back to it.
Why don't we linger here and see if it comes back?
Okay. Okay, what I was going to say is that this season...
Is this what you were going to say, or are you just filling the silence?
No, this is actually
Did it work?
Say. It worked, yeah.
Oh my God, come on. Now I can't wait.
But I think it was John Muller yesterday put up a viz showing that...
The Athletic's John Muller.
The Athletic's John Muller, indeed. Yeah, showing that Spurs are getting, for the amount of possession that they're having...
You've forgotten again, haven't you?
Final third passes, John.
Final third possession, or passes.
Oh, well, that's the same thing, isn't it?
I suppose so. Basically, Spurs have much more attacking upside from the amount of possession and the ball they have in the final third, right?
Wait. Say all that again. I didn't hear. I can't understand
you. If you're a football team, you're more likely to score if you have the ball in the final third.
I would say correct.
Okay.
Yes.
If you map all of the teams across Europe according to like how many goals they're scoring and how much possession they're having in the box, Spurs are a massive outlier. So they're not having the ball in the final third that much, but they're still scoring at a high rate.
So would that suggest that would come down, the scoring
rate? I mean, we can argue about that, but I think what's interesting about that is that if you... Coming back to why Spurs... Why Conte teams might not be as good in knockout competition is that if you're in those sorts of situations against better teams, I guess you're less likely to come away with wins. So obviously you only need to lose like one game in a knockout tournament in order to be on the back foot.
Yes.
So that could be a reason why.
Presumably part of it also is just because of the caliber of forward player that they have.
Sure.
Yeah.
So if you're allowing the opposition a lot more possession, they've got better forwards, then you could struggle.
I'm glad you remembered it. Personally, I think that was interesting.
Hmm.
Yeah, I wonder what the listeners at home will think.
I don't think I explained it very well. So
no, I think
they may have tuned out.
I think the second time round you did.
Okay,
I'm with you.
Good.
Yeah. Anyway, let's talk about transfers after a break.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Ah, delightful break. I had a lovely time. Transfers. Lots of very fair number of transfers. Nathan A. Clark. Richarlison, of course, the big'un that came in this summer. Transfer marked have this down as 52, but I remember reading it was 60, or maybe that was 60 million euros. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
With add-ons, I presume.
Yes. Yves Bissouma, we see, hasn't played that much. Also a player hasn't played that much as Jed Spence. We have Ivan Perisic came in on a free, as well as Clement Longley, amongst others. And of course, before that, in the January transfer window, there were the two stellar signings of Dejan Kulusevski and Bentancur. Mm. What's his first name?
Rodrigo
Bentancur, who seemed to make an instant improvement with the team. How do you feel so far about the performances of the players who arrived this summer, to the extent that we've seen them?
Yeah, we haven't. Well, the main thing is that we haven't seen a ton of them yet. Mm. Which you're always going to get to an extent with Conte. He wants them to learn the patterns, right?
Yes.
He wants them to learn the exact system inside out, prove their ability with them before they see the pitch at all, right?
Richarlison, we've seen a fair amount.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, the forward-most player is the player with the most freedom to finish moves however they like. Mm. But also, I think he has so much graft, and he's come off the bench so well that he's forced his way into the team. I think in a way that has negatively affected the team for three games on the bounce.
Really?
Right?
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's not a criticism of Richarlison. Let me clarify that. But Richarlison's brilliant, but we've gone through a period of time where Kane and Son have not been dropped, right? Because of course they're excellent. Richarlison's come off the bench, been excellent himself, deserves a start as a result. So Kulusevski has been on the bench. Problem with that is that Kulusevski is the carrier of the ball, the creator, the person who links the forwards to the midfield, the midfield to the forwards. Richarlison is another forward, right? So we've had this really disbalanced team where you have this sort of FIFA lineup of three strikers and not much supply getting to them. We went back to having Kulusevski start against Leicester and we were a lot better for it, I think.
Were you surprised to see him start on the bench for a few games, Kulusevski? Because, I mean, I haven't paid that close attention to Spurs, but everything I've heard has suggested that he's been maybe their best player since January.
I think there's a good case for that. I think
producer Don nodding over there in the corner, Spurs fan. He agrees so hard with me that he's silently nodding. Thank you, Don.
So Son went on this stretch without scoring, right? Yeah. And Conte was very consistent in the press. He's brilliant. He's an incredible player. He's getting the shots. A little expected goals kind of side reference there. He will start scoring. Of course he will, and he has done now.
A hat-trick against Leicester.
The inside left role sort of isn't great for him outside of him being played through. He doesn't receive the ball well in front of the defence very well. So when he's not scoring, he doesn't play very well on Conte, essentially. The previous North London derby aside. So there's been calls for us to drop Son, but then he's wanted to demonstrate his confidence in Son by playing him through that period.
Which you'd have to say has worked, arguably.
Well, he finally benches Son. Son comes for Kulusevski to start. Son comes off the bench, scores a hat-trick. I think...
Final part of the master plan.
Yeah, of course.
The automatism of how to deal with human emotions.
You got it. But it's just left us in this awkward phase for a little bit where Kulusevski wasn't starting games, and I think that we are actually quite reliant on him to play the games we want to play.
Okay. What about other players then, aside from... Actually, tell me what Richarlison does offer. You've described him already as a kind of like another forward and maybe not one to replace Kulusevski, but what is it that he does offer, even if it is coming off the bench?
Well, his graft is incredible. He sort of profiles most similarly to Son in that he is a threat running in behind and a goal threat who can play in the two wide positions. Hopefully the main thing that he will bring this season, which through no fault of his own, he's failed to do so far pretty much, is take some minutes away from Kane and Son and allow them to rest. So I guess finally at the weekend against Leicester, he put Son on the bench.
You were quite angry after the Champions League game, right?
Yeah.
Because
which one, John?
The
Sporting.
The recent loss against Sporting, because you're seeing Richarlison, as I understand, as a player who can come in for Kane in those games.
Yeah.
And it just gives you a little bit more flexibility. But Richarlison, as you're saying, is being used as a wide forward pretty much exclusively so far.
Yeah, I don't mind him. I mean, obviously, at some point, Kane needs to rest, right? And Richarlison is the natural... or the closest to natural replacement for that, right? Richarlison has more of the physical presence that Son doesn't have to play his centre forward role. He can't turn on a dime and ping a 50-yard perfect lofted through ball like Gangan, no one can, right? Messi, whatever. But he should be able to do a role in the centre forward position, and maybe he needs a while longer to learn that role in training, which is what we're not seeing.
Mm.
But while he's not taking minutes from Kane and Son, he's doing everything brilliantly well, but he's not doing the main purpose of him, again, through no fault of his own.
Okay. Yves Bissouma is a player that was, you know, like long touted by, you know, other fans of top six sides coming from Brighton. He hasn't really played very much, has he?
So again, this is a really sort of good timing. He hasn't played much. He looks rough in the game that he played. I can't remember which one. West Ham, maybe?
I think it was, yeah.
Very, very simplified passing game, which is actually what you saw from him last season at Brighton, playing as the deepest midfielder there, because the way Graham Potter likes to use his wide centre-backs. But yeah, it's taken a while to adjust to the automatisms of Conte. And then against Leicester, came off the bench, allowed Spurs to switch to a three-man midfield, which they needed in that game because they were being overrun.
With him as the deepest player.
With Bissouma as the deepest player, allowing Højbjerg and Bentancur to be much more aggressive defensively and also being aggressive in his own sweeping behind those two. And without necessarily being excellent himself, although I think he was fine, what he allowed us to do tactically in that situation was really strong and promising for what he can do going forwards. Mm.
It's always interesting when bigger teams buy players that I would consider, you know, that maybe would be a starter in many other teams. When they don't get minutes, I think there's a problem. But then I forget that, like, at the biggest teams, they just have incredible squads where players do only play 24 Premier League games a season, for example. With Bissouma, do you think it's one of those cases? Is he intended to be a rotation option in a team that doesn't rotate very often?
Well, I think that was the intention, is that we have like six wing-backs on the book nearly.
Mm.
We have five central midfielders.
Yeah.
So the idea is for us to rotate. We haven't seen it so much so far.
But are these Paratici? How do I say his name?
Paratici.
Are these Paratici signings or are these... Why are you laughing at me?
No, it's fine.
How dare you laugh at me on my podcast? Are these Paratici signings or are these Conte signings? Like, who would have done that one?
So the history is that Levy was our recruitment department, and we stepped away from that, brought in Paratici, and
I believe it's Paratici.
Sure. He sort of overtook what was happening under Nuno, I think, for the most part, and then... Most of what happened in the summer was you know, a back and forth, the discussion between the two Italians and who the profiles Conte was looking for and who they wanted to bring in.
Right.
Jed Spence was, as I understand it, a Levy operation, a little side project to keep him busy.
I see.
Yeah.
But is that perhaps why
I was
going to
say, traditionally, Conte has always like rotated his wing-backs, right? He subs his wing-backs off at 60 minutes. So that's a sort of accepted rotation. So that is a bit weird for him to not be doing that as much, right?
Yeah, I think he wants to. I think he knows he should. For Emerson Royale to have played as much as he could is quite something. It speaks to his own stamina to have done those minutes. Again, we have the numbers in the squads. I think it's about getting Doherty's fitness, Spence's readiness. We've seen the rotation on the left side. It's just that the left side is now affecting, or the right side is now affecting the left side because Perisic started on the right in the previous game.
And what about Clement Longley?
He's good. I like him.
Mm-hmm. Is he playing in one of the outside centre-back roles?
Yeah, as a left footer, he is being now pretty evenly rotated with Ben Davies, although I think that he will, if he hasn't already, sort of usurped Davies as the first choice left-sided centre-back. But I think it's going to continue to be pretty even between the two of them. The concern with him was that he was extremely error-prone at Barcelona. I went back and sort of looked over his history of errors in his performances for Barcelona, and I think that he was pretty unfairly, overly criticised. The shape that Barcelona have been in for the last few years. He's an improvement on the ball on Ben Davies, and Ben Davies isn't bad on the ball. As you know, sort of he's had a full career as a good ball-playing left fullback, right?
Hmm.
And hasn't made defensive errors, which I guess is sort of the main thing we're looking for there. So yeah, Longley's come in and done the squad improving rotation thing that he's meant to have done.
Mm. Well, John, a while ago, before the season began, you made a video about Tottenham and how close they were to finishing, you know, breaking up the sort of duopoly of Man City and Liverpool. And I believe we're going to play a clip from that now.
I'm John McKenzie. Oh, they're so good at the game.
That's what you sound like. But do tell me about that, because a lot of your analysis was focused on how many points a team requires to sort of breach that top one and two. It's also worth caveating with saying that you did make this before the season began, and Liverpool are rubbish, aren't they? That's the word on the street. They're crap.
Yeah, it's also worth caveating that I don't sound constipated in all of my videos. So if you haven't
some
managed to catch my videos,
some of them.
Be aware. Yeah, I think it's really interesting looking back on that video now, because we were just assuming that Manchester City and Liverpool were just going to do what Manchester City and Liverpool do, and that hasn't been the case. I think both Manchester City and Liverpool have dropped, you know, I mean, certainly Liverpool have dropped more points than they did last season.
City have dropped 4 points, I believe. They're still unbeaten.
Do we know how many they dropped last season?
I'm really sorry, I don't know that. I can find out while you're talking.
Yeah, okay. This is very much an outlier situation, so the context has changed. So it may even be the case that you don't even need to reach the height that you needed to reach in previous seasons to actually be a title challenger. And I think for me, as we started out with, the big question is going to be whether or not we see any improvement from Spurs from here on in. But I'd be interested on actually Nathan's opinion on. So you played the 3-5.
I've got an answer for you. Okay. I'm so sorry to interrupt. I figured that was a good opportunity just in the middle of your discussion. Yeah. Manchester City actually only had 14 points at this time last season, whereas now they have 17. So one win fewer. In fact, they'd lost a game and presumably drawn two as opposed to just drawing. So currently unbeaten, they're performing much better. Liverpool, of course, had 15 points at this time last season, so are not doing well at all. And Chelsea were top of the league with 16 points. Imagine. Last season did as well as a number of teams have done this season.
Okay. Well, ignore everything I've just said, but okay. I am interested in Nathan's thoughts on moving to the 3-5-2, which is what you did against Leicester, right? Do you think that will be something that you see more in future? And how does that change the automatisms, the shift between the two?
Can you also describe what the difference between those two would be?
So because everything is so automated, the productive differences in possession aren't that great. I guess the main thing there is like what happens to Kulusevski, right? Which I just spent a while talking about why when we went three games without Kulusevski starting, we couldn't produce much in possession. We couldn't finish off our moves. So could he play as one of the number eights in the midfield three? I prefer the way it covers space defensively. I think that when we play the 3-4-3, we get pushed into a 5-4-1. The wingers get really pinned back into the defensive line, and that makes it really hard for us to push out, to press, to regain our own possession and stuff like that. Whereas a 3-5-2, I think, covers that space a little nicer.
I guess you're using your wing backs for width there rather than wide players, right?
Yeah. I guess the thing is that like the profile that Conte wants from his midfield two are like a couple of burly boys who get up and down and do a bit of everything, right? Whereas the midfield three is much more specialized. You've got a number six who's this regista, and then you've got one of the back and forth players, and then a sort of a more dynamic, more creatively free, more advanced central midfielder on the opposite side. I like to think Kulusevski could play that role. I don't think he has done so far in his career, but I think that could be a fit for him. It would mean, I guess, therefore, dropping one of Højbjerg and Bentancur, and that sort of feels a little hard to imagine at the moment. The 3-5-2 made sense in that particular game because of the situation in it. Although, having said that, I feel like we've probably had the midfield overrun a few times this season, and that's probably played a significant part in our discussion of us having the ball so little this season. So Spurs fans are kind of crying out for the 3-5-2. I really wanted to see more of it last season when Conte first came in. The main question is Kulusevski.
Hmm. So, do you think they can finish second? I mean, do you think they can finish first?
I don't think they can finish first because Man City exists. City. I mean, we're going to talk about Erling Haaland again in a bit.
We are.
And that will help contextualize a lot of this. But
yes.
I think there's no reason why they shouldn't be battling out for that second spot. And it's going to be a really fun end to the season, right? Because you've got to feel like Liverpool are going to, I don't know, something's going to change with Liverpool, like whatever that is, but you've also got Chelsea with Graham Potter, and I think that is going to see them sort of climbing back up the table as well. Arsenal look good and Spurs are there and thereabouts. But I'm
Manchester United look far less hopeless than they did before.
Yeah, and they're certainly putting pressure on anyone sort of having a wobble in terms of the top four. But yeah, for me, I just don't think that the way things are at Spurs at the moment is sustainable. So something is going to have to change if they are to continue putting up that sort of points total. But
something as simple as the switch to 3-5-2?
Yeah, there's any number of things that could be done to change that. I guess Nathan and I have disagreed on this.
I was going to say, this is where you disagree. He's hopeful that things will improve. You're expecting that they won't.
Yeah, and I say that because a lot of the opinions that I'm developing about Spurs are based on some of the data viz that I'm seeing. And that's not to say that I don't agree that if Spurs change, that they'll get better. That's just true. But I think as things are at the moment, the big question is, are Spurs just sort of breaking the model? So they simply, because they've got that front three who are just probably the most elite three in, I'm not going to say something like that, but they're very good.
PSG exists. So yeah.
Well, I was going to say in the Premier League, but they are one of the best front threes in the world, certainly at playing without the ball that much. In which case, there's a sense in which you don't need to have possession of the ball that much when you are developing your whole system to bait the opposition in, create space for those three to just feast. So there's a sense in which, they are an outlier. But for me, the big question is how big of an outlier are they going to be?
And how do you disagree with John?
Well, I think that we will be an outlier to an extent, as we've seen historically with Conte, right? But I don't think that we will keep up. Oh, you just need one final third pass from Kane to Son and that's a goal for the rest of the season. I think that we will see a lot more of the ball as the season goes on. I think that I'm sort of getting out of my comfort zone here, but I think that there is a periodization element to speak of in terms of we're building our fitness slowly and looking for the long haul and a very long season with two games a week forever. And we've also sort of been coming on late in games a lot, getting really sharp around the 80th minute.
You said something interesting on the extra inch the other day that whilst you haven't been pressing very much so far, the upside of that is that presumably you would think you might have a bit more energy come the end of the season when other teams are running out of steam.
Yeah, quite possibly. And I think an individual game is kind of a microcosm of the season in terms of fitness, in terms of us. We've been pressing more towards the end of games. We've been having more sort of athletically dynamic counterattacks towards the end of games. And those new purchases who haven't seen a lot of the pitch yet, developing, coming into the game, should give us that depth and that rotation and that fitness to see the season through.
And they'll be out of the Champions League soon enough as well, so they'll have fewer games.
There we go. Well, that was Spurs. Let's have another break, and when we come back, we'll discuss other things.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Roberto Di Zerbi. I love to say that name. Roberto Di Zerbi has been made to be forced through force to be the Brighton manager. I don't think any of those things I just said were true. But we talked a tiny bit about him last week, John. But tell me much more now.
Yeah, so Roberto Di Zerbi is, I suppose, a bit of a darling of the tactics nerd world. He's had a really...
Nathan's basically glazed over, hasn't he?
Yeah,
all dewy eyes.
He has basically taken a really unique route, I suppose, through management so far. So started out, he had a really interesting playing career. So he played at a lot of sort of Serie B, Serie C teams. He did play for Napoli for a bit. He started out at AC Milan. So he was a good player.
He's been there at the elite level.
Yes, you could say that.
Just about.
His route through management has been with smaller clubs as well in Italy, largely. So places like Foggia, Palermo, Benevento is where he made his big name. because he was playing this really exciting brand of football. Actually kind of similar to Antonio Conte in that he likes to build up from the back by sort of overloading at the back and pulling teams forward. Mm. So just have lots of your own players sitting deep, doing like small, sharp passing movements and pulling the opposition in and then generating space to exploit further down the field. Hmm. So yeah, burst on the scene at Benevento. Benevento were struggling.
Benevento.
Yeah, they were struggling in that season. They did get relegated, but he impressed enough to get a job straight away at Sassuolo.
Hmm.
And that's where I think most people will remember him. But he went from Sassuolo to Shakhtar Donetsk, which, I mean, I guess it's Champions League football, but it's not the next obvious step that you would think for a manager like him. Mm. And I suppose Brighton is, obviously the things at Shakhtar went badly wrong with the geopolitical situation there. But Brighton, I guess, another interesting place to go. He'll be a club where they are going to provide him with the players that he needs to play the sort of football that he wants.
And presumably be in the Champions League next season anyway, right?
We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Okay, do you like him, Nathan?
I like him a lot. I think he's sort of the obvious hipster's choice, Brighton method kind of thing that you would expect to see from them. So at Sassuolo, he played like wide fullbacks and narrow wingers. And then at Shakhtar, he played wide wingers and narrow fullbacks. I wonder if he will come in, look at that Brighton squad and just be like, yep, this is built for a back three. So I'm going to carry on with the back three. That'd be interesting to see whether he does that. And we've also, with that, he has the experience being sort of like a mid-lower table type squads and outperforming that, and also being at Shakhtar, being the dominant team and enforcing that dominance through like enormous amounts of possession as well. So, yeah.
He has quite a big task on his hands. Not necessarily, I mean, obviously he's got a good squad and an exciting team, and I don't think there's any real negatives on the footballing side of things. But of course, Graham Potter will have left a big old fat hole to fill. That's the job, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess the big question is like, how quickly is he going to have an impact there? And I suppose with the players that that Graham Potter has developed, who are just really tactically flexible and able to move in between different systems quite comfortably, I suspect it won't be the worst period for them to get used to having a new manager. But the difficult thing, I think, is just the position they have in the table right now.
Mm.
Like, Graham Potter is a great manager and has been a great manager for three seasons. But, you know, the last season when they finished ninth or whatever it was the first time that really translated into a decent league position. Finished before that, they were always sort of still flirting on the edges of relegation. So I still think this is a squad where a mid-table finish is overperforming.
Yeah.
So the big question is going to be, are the media going to just say, well, when Potter left, Brighton were pushing for European spots?
Yes.
If De Zerbi
doesn't do that.
Certainly
what I would be saying if I had to title a YouTube video.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. But if De Zerbi doesn't continue at that rate, are people going to say, well, you know, he's no Graham Potter, is he?
Which he won't. I mean, perhaps that's the biggest struggle, right? Like, pretty much anything is going to feel like a downturn, I suppose, isn't it? Even if they perform well and have a 12th place finish and, you know, win a couple of big games, like, it's still going to feel like, you know, you watch Potter finishing in the top four, it's still going to feel underwhelming.
Yeah, I think we're so early on in the season that a couple of the big teams haven't performed well and they will probably catch up, and that it's just natural that Brighton will drop out of that sort of real top half of the table. But
okay, another team that one would assume will be looking for a coach at some point in the near future is Leicester, who of course lost 6-2 to Spurs, Nathan, over the weekend. Brendan Rodgers was fairly candid in his post-match interview about what his, you know, likely expectations are going forwards, and I did not read it yet, but I did see the promotion of a piece written by Michael Cox where he suggested that perhaps a departure would be the best thing for both parties. When you watched them be decimated by Son in the second half, does it just seem like it's over to you watching?
Leicester were, I think, pretty strong between sort of 30 and 60 minutes in that game, right? There's Rodgers, obviously, we can speak to his Swansea, his Liverpool, his Celtic. He is a good tactical coach. Leicester came with some interesting ideas towards that game, gave us significant issues with overloading our midfield and things like that. There's talent in that squad too. It's just that there's also big holes in that squad, and I think there is fatigue that you get with any coach in any team, pretty much, that it can't just carry on going downhill forever. yeah, I don't know if anyone's necessarily going to come in and do a much better job than Rodgers, other than, you know, save them from relegation kind of thing. There's talent in that squad that should be pushing for Europa League, and I just don't think that they're going to be around there because of the injuries and the lack of investment. I wonder even if they can, like, afford to pay Rodgers out of his contract.
It sounds like a lot of money. I mean, John, Gary Lineker said on Match of the Day that, as Nathan indicated there, that there were actually a number of positives to take from the game. But my thought was, if there's a number of positives to take and the team still concede 6 goals, that does feel over.
It's worth saying that Son's first 2 were just incredible goals. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you concede...
Left and right, yeah.
You concede one of those and you're like, well, you know, what can you do? You concede 2 and you're just like, there's a God and he hates us, right?
Sure.
So I think it's worth keeping that in mind. But Rodgers has got into a position now where poor results are going to end up becoming like calls for his sacking, yeah, because of the wider context. So we can say, you know, you have a good result or good performance, we should say, every once in a while, and I don't think it really does enough to keep the people at bay. But I think there's been this trajectory in Rodgers' career, right? I've got a lot of friends who are big Celtic fans, and obviously he was an incredible coach at Celtic, but they do tell me that, you know, it started off so well and did become more stale, like it became less fun.
Yeah.
And I wonder the extent to which, you know, that's what's happened with him at Leicester, right? You have a couple of really good seasons where he's motivating the squad to be in and around the Champions League spaces, but the drop-off this season has just been so vertiginous that it's hard to, like...
Well, they have one point after 7 games. I mean, they're dead bottom,
yeah.
1 draw. That's bad.
Yeah, and so Michael Cox is right. Like, what do you do in that situation?
Yeah.
The easiest thing to do is just change the manager, regardless of whether or not there's good reasons for keeping them.
I think that description of really good at the start and then crashing and burning pretty fast is an accurate description of what happened at Liverpool too, right? So there's a pretty strong track record there. 2-year contract only for Rodgers is the tip going forwards, I guess.
I wonder what it is. I wonder what happens.
It's the envelopes, isn't it?
What's the envelope?
It's the Being Liverpool documentary where he comes forward. He stole this from Fergie. I think he's got. I've got 3 names in these envelopes of 3 players who will let me down this season. And the reveal at the end is that there were no names. That's sort of like David Brent type nonsense. Maybe
that's what you did with us, but it was actually our name.
Yeah,
it was just everyone's name.
And I was proven right, and will be proven right again this season.
It motivated us, to be fair.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, motivated
stroke
you
of genius.
Shit. Okay, moving on from Brendan Rodgers. Max Allegri's Juventus are rubbish.
So bad.
They're so bad, Nathan, aren't they? Is he going? I mean, John made this sort of, you know, the point on last week's podcast and just before we recorded today. Thomas Tuchel is available.
I think that there are such strong similarities between Allegri and Mourinho that finding a way to win against all odds when things are on the up and then... worse than Rodgers. Like when him and the squad are tired of each other, when there's no structure at all to what they're trying to do on the pitch, it is horrendous to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Juventus are really interesting, right? Because we did the video on them recently and they made that decision that they needed to be better in Champions League. So they needed to bring in what they deemed to be a sort of like more cutting edge modern coaches. Mm. They brought in Sarri and they brought in Pirlo, both which are pretty risky options. But objectively, if you look at the data, both of those coaches improved Juventus.
The
team. Yeah,
yeah.
From when they had... when they had Allegri the first time round, and their solution was that when Pirlo had a bit of an unlucky on the performance of expected points, basically, and Inter won the league under Conte, of all people, they just got rid of him, panicked about the whole thing, and brought Allegri back. And so it just feels as though I don't know, what's the phrase, one step forward, 2 steps back. But they've ended up being with the same person, but worse than they were. So, yeah, it feels like a weird one to me because it almost felt as though they were ready to make that next step that like big clubs need to make, you know, bring in your Pep Guardiola and then suddenly you become, you know, a traditional club, but with a really good manager and with all the players that you can get. And
it's like leaving a long-term partner and then thinking you're going to have a new life, but then like you have a couple of scary dates. when things don't work out quite so well, or someone wants to try something with you that you're afraid of, and then you go back to the old partner and you stay forever because you realize that even if that's the wrong thing to do, it's still safer than the right thing. You know what I'm saying?
Do you need to talk about this?
Not at all. I never want to talk about it.
I'd go on a date with PLO, but I feel like Sari wouldn't be into that so much.
Mm, yeah. Where is PLO now?
Nowhere. He's really good and someone should hire him.
Yeah. He's in Turkey, yeah.
He's in Is he managing in Turkey?
Oh, I'm
believe so.
Wow. Nathan believes that Turkey is nowhere. Please say that, everyone.
It's not in Europe. It's not in Asia.
He's not wrong. Where is Turkey?
Do you know who else is not wrong? David Moyes. When he told that guy who called him Moisey that we weren't that close. That was funny. Did you see that on the Twitter, on the internet there?
Oh, I didn't know.
Guess a journalist called him Moisey before he asked him a question. And then he laughed and said, I don't think we're that close. And that's the first thing that came into my head. But West Ham lost to Everton over the weekend, which is difficult to do. What's going on there, John?
Yeah, West Ham are a funny club. I've talked a little bit, I think, on this podcast about how they seem to be one of the beneficiaries of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
If it's okay to use that turn of phrase, maybe it isn't, but it felt as though Moyes has his team playing.
Very insensitive.
Yeah,
isn't
it is, really. I'm sorry if anyone.
Do you want to rephrase that?
Can we just carry on going?
Would you like to make an apology?
I'm sorry. I'll look at the camera. I'll do better in future, Joe.
But what you mean is they were a beneficiary of not having a crowd?
No, a beneficiary of playing a style of football, I think, that benefited from like the unusualness of, I've used the word benefit a lot there.
Yeah, you're really leaning into it, aren't you?
But he got the better of the situations where you, because his teams are like,
what are you saying? What is it you're saying?
I'm trying not to use the word benefit, but benefit is the really only word head. That I can think of.
Are you saying? There. Let me try and say this for you. Are you saying that an unusual circumstance was created by the global pandemic coronavirus?
Yes.
And in some ways, actually, that worked to the benefit of West Ham because they were playing a sort of football that they might not have been able to play had a crowd been there egging them on to try different.
But it's
things.
Not just crowds. I think it's also the fact that we weren't able to have as much training, and so that mm-hmm. pressing is going to be down.
Oh, I see.
Like in possession stuff is going to be less rehearsed, etc., etc. So the teams I think who did well in those situations are the teams that where it's just sort of you have your solid structure, you have a few good players in there who can like, for example, Mikhail Antonio is a great sort of player. If you're going to play sort of bog standard, sit deeper, absorb pressure, play the ball long. You've got players like Bowen, Benrahma, Antonio as well. They're going to benefit from those sorts of situations. And what's happened is we've come out of the
benefit.
We've come out of the pandemic period, and teams are just getting back to where they were before. And I think that West Ham just they don't have Moyes doesn't have the possession structure, etc., to be able to actually now compete at that level.
Right.
I think those things about both the crowd pressure and also the fitness were very true under Mourinho. At Spurs, and then when crowds were back and fitness was up, his football looked more outdated again. Although maybe Roma were proving all of that wrong, so I don't know.
Okay. Julian Nagelsmann. Bayern haven't won in 4 games in the Bundesliga, which, John, is the first time in how long?
I think it was 2001.
1 million years. Incredible. You've been banging on for ages about how they have just decided to start playing Red Bull football and you hate it. You've got an agenda. You take every opportunity to ridicule it or criticize it when those opportunities present themselves. I believe you did that at the weekend on Twitter. Very embarrassing for you. But what is this? What is the situation?
Yeah, so on the one hand, I mean, I'm really interested by Bayern and agenda against Red Bull football aside. I do find it fascinating that Nagelsmann's taken the sort of really stereotypical positional football that we see from people like Pep Guardiola. I mean, there's a lot of similarities between the way that Bayern were playing last season and the way that Man City play. He's taken that and he's switched with Lewandowski going. He switched his approach up so that there's now much more ideas that are anti-positional. So you're not necessarily trying to spread the back line of the opposition by having like touchline hugging wingers, etc.
And
you're trying to fashion a little bit more in terms of just getting direct attacks through the middle, destabilizing the opposition and benefiting from those sorts of situations. So I think Bayern just are interesting anyway. But what's even more interesting is that they've been unlucky. They've lost a couple of games, they've drawn a couple of games when they probably should have won.
Mm-hmm.
And then they lost the game against Augsburg. And looking at the underlying numbers, like they they put up a huge amount of expected goals against. So it's not like they were unlucky in that sense. So Nagelsmann clearly feeling the pressure right now. But it's just interesting that a team, an elite team, has said, right, we're going to change our style of play, and it's not working out for them at the moment. And you can't really do, you can't really not win four games in the Bundesliga as Bayern and get away with it.
Do you think that Nagelsmann will leave Bayern and then go and replace Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool? I mean, that's quite specific, do you think, isn't it? But that's what I think.
I mean, it could happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Bayern will stick it out. I think they would have sacked him already if they were going to be that short-term about it.
Oh, I don't mean sack him soon. I just mean, you know, he'll leave before the end of the season.
So the big question is if Liverpool would sack Klopp.
Well, no, but Klopp might just decide to sort of have a bit of a break or something, wouldn't he? Or, you know, I don't know.
Probably not mid-season, I wouldn't have
thought. No, at the end of the season. I'm talking about next season.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for.
It's weird, isn't it, that he played like Bayern ball at Leipzig and now he's playing Red Bull football at Bayern.
Weird. But I find it fascinating.
Okay, we played this game earlier before the podcast started, which was guess the goal conversion percentage. And we did that for...
Do you want to say that again?
Guess the goal conversion percentage. I like to say conversion to save time. goal conversion percentage. We did this with Spurs. Nathan wasn't here. Nathan, can you guess the Spurs player who has the highest goal conversion percentage? By which, of course, for listeners at home, I mean they've the number of shots by the number of goals...
It's going to be someone with one goal.
The person had more than one goal.
Oh, okay. Mm. So then Son, the more... No,
no,
right,
Son was very low. He'd taken so many shots. That was a poor guess.
I don't know what.
John also made that. Just to clarify, John guessed almost everyone on the team.
I did not guess Son.
You did?
No, Don guessed Son.
Don guessed Son. Okay.
Because I thought, Son hasn't scored many this season, so it's not going to be him.
But anyway, John guessed virtually everyone on the team before getting it correct.
Is this all competition or league only?
It's all competitions.
Richarlison?
No.
What?
He was fairly low.
Was it all competitions or was it Premier League?
It was all competitions.
Okay.
Someone must have like two goals. Dyer from set pieces.
It's Eric Dyer.
He's nailed it.
50% conversion rate. Now, Erling Haaland, I want to discuss because he's scored a number of goals already this season. I believe this is all competitions. 14 goals he scored in all competitions, which is quite extraordinary given that there have really only been 10 games for him so far. Would you like to guess his goal conversion statistic, John?
I reckon he's probably in the low 30s.
Would you like to guess a number?
No.
No. Well, then would you like to guess a number?
I'll go much higher. I'll say 47%.
And Don, producer Don, would you like to guess a number?
68.
Wow, Don's very wrong. John's kind of the closest. It's 38% goal conversion, which is very high for someone who scored 14 goals. Is he the best player? end of sentence.
Okay.
He's the best player at scoring right now.
Is he the best player in the world?
And again, it depends what you want your players to do, right? If you were to stick him in goal.
Score 14 goals from 13.
It wouldn't surprise
games.
Me if he was like a really good goalkeeper either, to be honest, but... Yeah,
just what I don't. I just like as a kind of layman watching him, I feel like I'm watching a new level, and maybe that is because I don't watch the overseas leagues as often, and so you know I remember seeing Cristiano Ronaldo at Manchester United before he left the Premier League, and watching him and thinking, oh wow, you're better than the other players that I've seen before, and I wouldn't say I've watched Lionel Messi regularly enough to fully appreciate that. But with Erling Haaland, you know, watching him at least in the highlights of him, like virtually every week for Manchester City, it's like looking at an alien playing football. It's like someone who has like a massive advantage, just, I don't know, based on being excellent.
Yeah, it's like when you play the early FIFA games and you could like build your own players and you could just make them really tall and hench. And that is what he is.
It makes me think of, when we play Rocket League, a video game we enjoy to play. And you play against... We don't enjoy to play. we hate playing it. But we play it anyway. If you play against a what we would call a smurf. A smurf is a player masquerading as a lower ranked player.
Yeah.
But in fact, they have the skills of a much higher ranked player. Yeah. Very annoying. Very annoying to play a smurf. But I've had pause for thought over the weekend, you know, thinking about Erling Haaland and wondering if you're just your run-of-the-mill Premier League defender... And you're defending Erling Haaland, or indeed the two goals that Son scored over the weekend, for example. Do you get the same level of irritation that I would get playing a smurf? Like, there's nothing I can possibly do about that, despite I play in the same league, the same sort of category. Technically, I play alongside this person. Mm. I am not within light years of their capacity.
The shame of him double flip resetting on Aston Villa.
Exactly, exactly. Don't you think it would be annoying?
Yeah, in the Champions League fixtures this week, Man City were losing to Borussia Dortmund. Mm. Borussia Dortmund brought on Nico Schlotterbeck, who's one of my favourite players in the world and is one of the best centre-backs in the world. I know that's probably controversial because he can sometimes do flappy things, but I've seen him play against Robert Lewandowski and keep him quiet. I've seen him play against Erling Haaland and keep him quiet. But then obviously there was that goal with Cancelo with the outside of his boot, and then Haaland just sort of jumps an incredible distance in the air, uses his wrong foot in the situation, and scores the goal, which means that they win the game.
Yeah.
And you just kind of think, when you're that player, when you're like, you know, I'm one of the best centre-backs in the world, I've done everything correctly here, and he's still scored against me. It must be horrible, really.
It's amazing, isn't it?
He's like a cyborg specially designed to cheat at football.
Yeah. Well, anyway, well done to Erling Haaland.
Can we talk about him every episode?
I think we should just check in each week to see if he's scored again, and he probably will have done. I'm starting to believe there won't be a game week where he doesn't score a goal.
Yeah, at least in like Premier League and Champions League, he will almost inevitably score in one of those games. I mean, he's scoring at a rate much higher than 1 in 2, so that makes sense, right?
What is he going to finish on? Like 2 weeks ago, it was like 63 or something because he'd scored 2 hat-tricks in a row, right? Like, do you think he could break the record? Premier League record?
Absolutely.
What is the Premier League record?
The Premier League record is 34.
Premier League one season goal record.
It's Mohamed Salah.
Thirty-two.
There's someone else who's done it.
He's gonna smash that.
But the other record is like Premier League players in all competitions in the season, which is 44, I believe. Which is, I think, Ruud van Nistelrooy, and he's already like 23% through that with like seven plus two, so 9 games played.
Do you remember the season?
Apparently, Andy Cole scored 34 goals for Newcastle United in 93-94.
Yeah, but they had more games in that season.
93-94. Okay.
And 94-95, Alan Shearer scored 34 as well.
They had
more games.
After that, they were like, this is too many teams in the Premier League. We must.
Too many games in a season. What a smart idea that would be, right? Yeah. Do you remember Luis Suarez was up at like 20 goals by Christmas one season and then massively drops off? I thought he was going to shatter all the records as well. But Haaland is just such a freak.
I think that he's also joint with Salah, is that right? Suarez, the 32, is that right?
I believe so.
Yeah, so I think that must have been the same season. And then in
He's not. He has 31.
31.
In the 13-14 season.
Disgusting.
Which eclipsed the previous highest, which was Cristiano Ronaldo in 07-08.
It's all down to injury, right? If he stays fit, then it's almost impossible for him to not do it.
It's quite a number of people who've made it 30.
Kevin Phillips?
Yeah, there's 4 players who've finished on 30. Kevin Phillips is one of them.
Is Les Ferdinand one of them?
No.
I also feel like he has some like weird high scoring.
Les Ferdinand, 25 in the 95-96 season for Newcastle United. But
is there a weird name on there?
No. Oh, okay. No, there's just 3 names on there.
Van Nistelrooy, Van Persie.
Van Persie is on there for the Arsenal season of 11-12, 30 goals.
How many have we named? Just
2.
One. 2.
You named Kevin Phillips.
Oh, okay.
There's going to be a Spurs one that I don't know, and I'm going to be shamed internationally.
There's a couple of NLD players right here. I'll tell you that for sure.
Oh, Thierry Henry.
Thierry Henry's one of them, in the 03-04 season.
Bergkamp.
No, one of them's Harry Kane.
Oh, yeah.
Of course. 30 goals, Harry Kane in 17-18.
Yeah,
that's Pochettino, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Old daddy. There we go. Fine. Well, that's the end of the episode, I imagine. Nathan A. Clark. Thank you very much. People can listen to The Extra Inch on their chosen podcast provider and follow you on Twitter at where?
Nathan A. Clark.
Okay.
And The Extra Inch.
The Extra Inch. Jonathan McKenzie, people can follow you on Twitter, but they shouldn't. Is that right?
Yeah. That is absolutely right.
That's right. And thanks as usual to producer Don. Thank you, Don, for vigorous nodding today. There's a little bit of a... Can we see Don's hand waving? No, we can't. What a shame. It's a delightful hand. Anyway.
And thank you to producer Joe Devine today.
Well, no, I mean, there's editor Sean Thorne, who's back for a 2-week special because as I didn't want to mention it because I hate the man, but Steve Hankels isn't here, producer Hankels. He's away for 2 weeks on holiday because he doesn't take his job seriously. So thanks for editing, Sean Thorne. And we'll be back next week, I believe, with a cast that doesn't include myself. I'm away next week, and you'll be treated to the joy of a temporary host. That man is Norwich City's Michael Bailey. Yeah?
Norwich City's Michael Bailey.
Well, he's, you know, he belongs to Norwich City, really, doesn't he? Doesn't he, really? Excellent.
I hate for the people of Norwich to think that one of their footballers was coming on to host the podcast, though.
Yeah. I did. The thing is, I said it all wrong, and now you're making me...
It's okay.
The Athletic's Michael Bailey, the Norwich correspondent, a lovely man. We'll be joined by yourself, by JJ Bull, and also, I think, by Seb Stafford-Blore in the studio.
The real life studio.
The real life flesh basket of Seb Stafford-Blore.
The
flesh pots of Blore. So look out for that, and I'll see you again in a couple of weeks' time. Take care. Bye-bye, Tirana. See ya.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.